you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Greetings, citizens of Earth and all beings, both extraterrestrial and interdimensional. My name is Danny Roth, and this is Who Won the Week, Sci-Fi Wire's podcast dedicated to the top stories from the week in geek. I am joined this week by my co-hosts, the Blur Girl, Kara Mahorn, and Sci-Fi Wire's own editor-in-chief, Adam Swiderski. Hi.
Yo.
Hello.
It's always fun doing that super radio thing and then acting normal.
No, you're not acting normal.
Well, you're not normal.
Yeah. Whew.
It's a load off my mind.
It's not possible.
Oh,
we love you anyway, though. It's a safe space.
Thank you. Thank you. What's going on? How's everybody doing?
This week has been a long year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. This
Hope
week.
Hope everybody voted. Hope everybody got the vote out. You need to do that.
That was, we're not going to talk about that so much this week.
No.
Because there's not really a lot that we can do here on the Sci-Fi Channel to change a midterm election that already happened.
That's true.
So there's that. And so if you were looking for a break, congratulations. You're going to get it. Woo. Here we are. Lots of things happened this week that were not related to that. Stuff on TV. There's gaming stuff that happened in the world. There was some interesting commentary about Star Trek, which is about as political as we're going to get this week. And we also have lives.
We had a guest even.
We have a guest spot.
Well, I wasn't there, so I mean,
which means that's going to be the part of the podcast you're going to want to fast forward to.
Yeah.
Wow. You know, I was gonna save it for next week. But you know, next week, well, I've hit 3 years of this podcast, Adam.
Are you kidding me?
You have been doing this podcast with me for 3 years. Coming up next week,
it feels like so much more.
Oh my God!
I mean, just the last two years.
It feels like 5 years to me, and I've only been here a year.
I had completely different cells back then.
Oh my
yeah.
God.
All my cells have died and regenerated in the time.
And Karen has been around for over a year.
Wow.
Actually, it is over a year. Yeah,
you just hit over a year.
I've done my first episode. I think was 100.
Right.
So I would say there was one you did before that.
That's true.
But you did one at 100, and then I think you only missed
maybe
one or two before we officially announced you as the latest co-host. So I would say that
I came in looking for the bathroom, and I just sat down.
My favorite year so far.
All right.
Gets better every year.
Aww.
So, that's a thing that's come up, but...
I'm so a little shell-shocked. I need a moment to process this whole three-year thing.
Yeah, I had genuinely looked it up to try and figure out when you actually started, because I'm weird that way. I was like, when did it happen? How did we... When? Okay. That was it.
I like to imagine that is actually what you do when you're typing on your computer.
Can't see his face out there.
Oh, like, do I have a conversation
like they do
with
on TV.
Myself?
Like they do on TV, when they're typing and they're like... Search for whatever.
Danny's search typeface is classic. You can't see it.
I am. I'm alone in my house most of the time. My wife has a job that is out in the world, and I sit in my desk space, in my office, in my house. And so I talk to myself and the cat.
He talks to himself and the cat, apparently. And then the face that he makes looks like he sucked on a lemon and he lost his vision in one eye. So you can visualize that.
Hey,
that
ladies,
that's Danny searching.
So that is true. Anyway, hey, before we talk about the news of the week, we do this little thing where we talk about things that we personally geeked out about. Been doing it for up on 3 years.
Yeah, wow.
Adam,
yes,
you're the boss. Should we continue doing
this? It's always been my goal to talk about what I've been geeking out about for 3 years. So why stop now?
Oh, right.
I mean,
cool.
We're so close to the finish line.
Of life.
Well, in general, but also
sure,
the
so
3 year
close,
mark.
Yes, yeah. Yes, about to hit the 3 year mark. So, yes, going into year four. Sure.
Yeah.
All right, Adam, what do you, since you're so delighted and so excited.
Sure. I am delighted and excited.
Yeah.
I won't be indicted.
There you go.
Oh,
you're delightful and insightful. Tell me what you're geeking out about.
Well, I haven't had a lot of time to consume media this week, but I guess I'm geeking out about a project that I'm involved in.
Oh, yeah?
which is a I'm performing in a zombie rock musical.
Oh.
Yeah. It's taking place in
Brooklyn.
Wait.
Well, We're not glossing over that. A zombie rock musical.
Well, let me be even more specific. It is a zombie Jesus rock musical. Basically, the premise of it is that Jesus comes back for the second, or technically third coming, I guess. But this time he is a zombie, like an actual zombie with a lust for flesh. And he comes upon this town and starts turning people into zombies.
Oh,
so technically it's genre. It's a little more satirical. On the concept of religion, and it is a musical. I am playing bass and singing and acting in this.
Are you Jesus?
No.
Are you one of the disciples?
No, my character's name is John Goodman, but it's not that John Goodman.
I'm like, when did John Goodman become part of the...
No, it's, and there's another character in the town named Jason Priestley, but he's not that Jason Priestley.
Well, wait, is your John Goodman a good man?
No, all the people in the town are pretty horrible, and so you don't feel bad when they become zombified.
Die.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, all right. Classic Final Destination style.
Indeed. So, yeah, no, but I guess, you know, people who have seen it, who I know, have compared it to Rocky Horror and that type of tone and vibe
on. Like a Repo the Genetic Opera kind of thing?
Yeah, it's just kind of grotesque, but the music's good. I rock the bass. So if you live in New York City or thereabouts and you're looking for something to do, come see The Testament of Josh is the name of the musical, because he comes down and at first they're like, who are you? And he can't tell them. And so he says his name's Josh. So it's called The Testament of Josh. And it's at the Brick Theater in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. We've got, I think, 4 more performances left. So check it out. See me rocking a bass. And...
That's it. Let me tell you something. That will inspire other people. Also, it's slap at a bass.
I don't slap the bass. I hate slap bass so much.
Whoa.
Like the Seinfeld theme makes my head explode. I just can't. There's something about it. I don't know what it is. It's like that and saxophone.
I just feel like a whole group got represented for the first time.
Yeah.
Wait. So like you don't like the sound of the saxophone?
I don't like the timbre of the saxophone at all. I can't. I don't know why. Like it's
but
just
the
something.
French horn is okay.
Yeah. All other brass I'm cool with. It's just something about the timbre of the saxophone.
Well, the sax is also technically a woodwind.
Is it really?
A woodwind?
Yeah. Anything's got a reed.
Oh.
Is a woodwind.
Oh, that's true. So you probably don't like clarinets either.
No, I do. I have no problem with clarinets. It's really specific to the saxophone. I don't know why.
We are gonna find an instrument that he likes. Poor thing.
Man.
I love all those instruments.
Except for that one.
Except for the saxophone.
This is the one. So does that mean you hate that scene in The Lost Boys?
I was going to say The Lost Boys theme. We're saying the same thing.
That guy gets a pass.
Oh.
Yeah.
Because it was because And also, he's been animated and everything. But it's so funny how we both went to.
Yeah.
There are a few saxophone ones that get a pass. That, Careless Whisper.
Yeah.
Exactly. Anything with Bruce Springsteen, Clarence Clemens gets a pass for all time.
Okay.
This is so funny. Our intern is just like, okay, the grandparents are talking.
Yeah. No, I went to see Nine Inch Nails recently, and Trent Reznor is playing, like, from the newer stuff. He pulled out the saxophone, and I was just like, no, why, Trent? No, put your guitar back on.
He's been taking lessons.
Or alternatively, your bass.
Or your bass, but don't slap it.
I'll tell you though, if you see somebody playing a bass, you're gonna want to play the bass. That's the truth. I've never met a guitar player who doesn't occasionally pick up a bass and go, "This is nice."
Well, it's because the bass is basically 4/6 of the guitar.
I was gonna say it's less strings.
It's just I just enjoy it.
You have room to.
Now, the thing is, if we're gonna be really technical here, like that's the thing. You can play some basic bass, if you're a guitar player, it's pretty easy because all the notes are the same on the fretboard. Blah blah blah. But like bass. Theory and technique is actually very different if you're going to be a good bassist, which I am not yet, but I'd love to be someday.
Yeah, I don't know. I just like the way that you're really working with the drummer. That's the beauty of it.
Yeah.
It's got a familiar muscle, but then anyway, this is not actually a music podcast.
Yeah.
But
nope.
I haven't played. Now I want to buy a bass. I don't have a bass anymore. I have one in high school. I got to get a new one. All right.
As long as you make the search face when you're playing.
But come see my play.
Okay. We'll all go see that play about Josh.
Yeah.
All right.
Who's Zombie Jesus?
Zombie Jesus. Yeah.
Karima.
Yes, I'm actually...
Can you top that?
I don't know. Maybe. I'm geeking out about two things. I'm geeking out about... I got to go to the Grinch green carpet. Actually, they're not calling it a red carpet. It's a green carpet.
You've been on many multicolored carpets this year.
I have. It's purple, red, and green. It's been kind of cool.
Yeah.
The highlight for me was talking to... Benedict Cumberbatch, I actually asked him if Dr. Stephen Strange, if the Space Stone took Stephen Strange to Whoville, what would be the first thing he would do? You're going to have to go to YouTube, Sci-Fi Wars YouTube channel, to see the answer to that. But it was funny. The other thing is, I talked to Tyler, the Creator, and Danny Elfman. And
Tyler, the Creator, is involved in the Grinch movie?
Tyler, the Creator, and Danny Elfman basically collaborated on the soundtrack.
Oh, wow.
And it is the most incredible thing.
Interesting.
So he's the one who redid, you can listen to it actually now, he redid Your Mean One, Mr. Grinch. And it actually sounds really good. I was going in going, this is going to suck.
See, this is the thing. Like, I would love to hear a Tyler, the Creator, Danny Elfman collabo, but not on the Grinch.
Well, yeah, no, but the funny thing is,
weirdly enough, I would love to see them just get weird and do their own particular thing.
And this is what I was going to say about music. This is really, it was turning into a music podcast. What's really funny about it is they hadn't met before this, but judging from the bro love that was happening on the green carpet, they are clearly going to do an album together.
I hope so.
Because Danny Elfman was like, it's been so long since I've been around just such raw creativity. Like, honestly, Tyler, the Creator, follows no rules, including the rules of a red carpet. Because he was just running up and down. He didn't care who was on a mic. He would just grab a mic. He would just talk. It was first time when he saw me at first, didn't speak to me, ran to talk to somebody else, and then saw me talking to Danny Elfman and came back. He's all over the place. But he definitely is. He lives up to his name. He's definitely always creating. Like, and he was fascinating to talk to. That he's also in the interview. And then the second thing that I'm geeking out about is Disney invited me to this exhibition they're having for Mickey's 90th birthday. It's called basically Mickey the True Original. And they literally took over the ground floor of a building on 10th and 15th. So it's at 16th and 10th. And basically it's an exhibition and every room is some type of tribute to Mickey. So they have all kinds of, there's mixed media, there's paintings, there's music, there's all kinds of things. And it's really interesting. I'm just going to name some of the artists. Darren Romanelli, Amanda Ross Ho, Kenny Scharf. Kenny Scharf is a contemporary of Andy Warhol and Basquiat. I remember seeing some art that he did with Jean-Michel Basquiat. So there's just, he's got an entire room. Shanique Smith. I mean, it's really sort of an experience. And it was a lot of fun. So if you get a chance, it's going to be there through, I think, February of next year. So if you get a chance, and I think it's not cheap. It's like $40, but I think kids might get in for free. You have to check. But if you go to DisneyTrueOriginal.com, you'll see it's really, really an interesting exhibit and not what I thought. I thought it was going to be all like swag and stuff. And they did have some swag in there, like Vans and opening ceremony have some collaborations. But it was fun. And it was the entire building is bright, bright yellow. And Mickey is like 20 feet like on the front of it. So if you're going up 10th, you can't miss it. So, yeah, those are two things I'm geeking out about.
Nice.
How about you, Danny?
Well, this is the first week that I did not have to do a podcast every day.
That's right.
Oh, right. There's no more horror podcast.
Are you having postpartum depression?
Post-podcast depression.
I slept so much. So the first thing that went my week was getting a break. That was real nice.
Yeah.
And what else did I do this week? Oh, we filmed some gift guides that I assume will come out in a couple weeks once Black Friday hits. And I like working with Jackie Jennings because basically my job when I work with Jackie is to laugh at her jokes, which is very easy to do. She just says outlandish things and I laugh a bunch and then they capture it and then they usually include one or two of them in the video and it's delightful. So I also wanted to make it seem like I do leave the house, but most of the things that I was geeking out about this week involved staying home. So I started getting caught up on TV.
Okay, there you go.
Man. Watched all of the season of The Flash so far. Real good. Really interested in the story. Really like they got the future daughter on there now. A lot of fun. She's having a good time. They got an interesting sort of dynamic between her and Iris that's kind of complex. They're actually letting Iris have, you know, her own goals, her own aims, her own direction, which I...
Yeah, a lot of fans were complaining that they were tired of her being like...
Yeah, she's doing a lot this season, so...
Sort of like furniture, so I'm glad they've given her
more
agency.
I'm enjoying that, and of course I got caught up on my number one fave show, Legends of Tomorrow,
mm-hmm.
And that show is just...
Is it still your favorite show?
It's adorable. It's just... They got John Constantine on as a regular now, and they have established that he kind of was dating one of the guys from the Time Bureau, this cheesy guy, Gary, and but he broke up with Gary, and Gary is not over it. And it's fun. I don't know. It's just there's adorable stuff. There's like a Little Shop of Horrors riff that they did, and there's unicorns and fairy godmothers and shapeshifters, and it's a real different sort of season. It's very magical this year, which is a cool change up. And anyway, it's great. It's real good. If you're not caught up on CW stuff, I would say at least those two shows. Those are the ones that I am still watching with regularity. I'll eventually get caught up on Supergirl, and I don't watch Arrow, but everything else, real good. And I got a book, which is Elements Fire.
This has come out, but they
just got it back in stock at Forbidden Planet, just a whole huge. So I got this in Beyond Part Two. But
yeah, and Tanika Stotz is the editor of that. I was actually a Kickstarter contributor, and I love that book.
Yeah,
she's going to do a series. This Elements is Fire, but I think the next one might be Water. I got to check. But I'm pretty sure it's all women of color creators.
I hope they do a love one, because that's the fifth element.
Wow.
Ah.
It's true.
Thank you, Bruce Willis.
You're welcome.
But it's beautifully done. And the way the images, the way they have just the hint of red, it's all black and white except for the same color red. That all the different, it's different artists and everything. But
yeah, I mean, this is so, when books like this come out, so this and Beyond, for example, Womanthology is another good one.
Mm-hmm.
These books, not only do you get these good short stories and they're really easy to kind of get through, but also if you are a comic creator, if you're a writer, if you're looking for an artist, if you're an editor and you're looking for people, this is really a great resource. Like, that's the other thing that I consider about these books, is not only are, if you're just a regular reader, are they enjoyable to have, but also they are this great source if you're looking for new talent.
Tanika Stotz and Spike Trotman are very good. Whenever they do, they always kickstart their books. They always do anthologies, and they always give a lot of first-time artists and writers a chance to be included. And I found some amazing people in both.
So, yeah, I would recommend. That's the other way I left my house, went to a comic book store, and physically bought a book. Didn't
and
even
then
get it
you
digital.
Went home.
And then I believe that I went back to my house and thought about how I didn't have to do a podcast until today. That was nice. So that's it. That's our show. Beep. No. Hey, I feel like we should throw to this Sabrina interview just because.
You want to do that first, or you want to do the news first?
Well, there's two schools of thought. What do you want to do? I was going to say the Sabrina thing is not really news in the sense that it's been
out
for a couple of weeks. So, and also I'm sure that people want to hear it.
Sure. So let's just throw to it.
So,
yeah. Interesting enough, speaking of theater, I go pretty far back with Joshua Conkle through the New York indie theater scene. Josh is a writer on Sabrina. He also wrote for A Series of Unfortunate Events on Netflix. And so, given our conversation last week and some of the stuff we talked about around the show, I thought it might be good to reach out to him and see if he wanted to discuss. And he was very willing. And so, yesterday, Karima and I sat down with him over the magic of Skype technology.
Nope, Danny wasn't invited.
Danny was not invited.
Harsh.
No, Danny couldn't be there. But Karima and I sat down with him and talked about just kind of, general stuff about how they go about writing the show and what their goals were. And then we also touched on some of the controversy that's come up around some of the characters. So we're going to throw to that now. Please join us when it's over. So we are joined now by Joshua Conkle, a person I've known for a long, long time. We go way back in the indie theater world of New York City. But who is now a writer for The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, a little Netflix show that you may have heard of.
we talked about it a few times.
Yeah, it's on the radar. Welcome to the Who on the Week podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. So how's it been since the show dropped, or what's the vibe among the people behind it? Are you guys psyched?
Yeah, we're all really psyched. I mean, the reception has been overwhelmingly positive. Netflix doesn't tell you anything about the numbers, but we get a vibe that they're good. So yeah, we're happy. We're really excited. Plus, you know, we're in the middle of season two already. So we've been a bit too busy to really stop and do a lot of reflection on the success of the first season.
Well, that answers my first question, because I was going to ask you, since you have done a Netflix show, do they give you your numbers? They don't give them to you either.
Oh, they give you hints. Like, they told us that our show is doing really well amongst teens and gays, and that it was really popular in Latin America. So they just give you little nuggets like that.
That's amazing.
That's awesome.
And Josh also, this is his second go-round with Netflix, because also worked on Lemony Snicket, right?
Yeah, I was on seasons 2 and 3 of A Series of Unfortunate Events.
Yeah.
Oh,
so,
wow.
So you are a Netflix veteran at this point.
I guess so, yeah.
Yeah. So what was it like? I guess we know now the reception is good. What was the vibe like when the show dropped?
It was great. I mean, you don't have any hard data at your fingertips, but this show compared to the last show I worked on, you know, I saw people that I wasn't directly connected to tweeting GIFs of the show and doing memes. And there was a lot of that stuff happening. And so I kind of got a sense that people were watching it and really engaging with it, which is really nice.
To rewind a little bit, as you came on to the show, as things were getting geared up with it, what were the things that were communicated to you and I guess to the writing team that kind of defined the show? What were the marching orders? What was the mission statement as you came in?
Well, I had a weird experience because I was the last writer in the door. The team had been working for many months before I was hired. I think Roberto felt that he didn't have quite enough writers, and so he hired a couple more right at the tail end of sort of staffing season, and I was the last of those. But mostly we had a lot of mandates about tone. We had a lot of things to read and watch. Luckily, I had already seen all of these things, so I didn't have that much homework. But his influences are things like Rosemary's Baby, The Omen, Tales from the Crypt comic books, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street, like any sort of like 60s through 80s horror film was kind of on the list. So that's what we were drawing from mostly.
Did they make you also read the comic book? The recent reboot of the comic book?
Yeah, they gave us that too, yeah.
How much of that did you have to stick to? Did they say, like, you know, make sure? Because I've read them and I found it interesting, some of the changes that were made. I feel like everything with the comic book is there, but not all the lines came from the characters that they were originally with. How did you guys make those decisions?
Roberto really makes those decisions. I think because he's the creator of the comic book, he feels a certain amount of freedom to stray from it. And there's a lot of things in the comic book that we just couldn't do in the show from a storytelling perspective. You know, no spoilers. I guess this is a spoiler, but like, we don't kill Harvey in the pilot episode. You know what I mean? Like, Harvey has to live.
And Betty and Veronica aren't the other witches. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And that's like a legal thing with CW. So, you know, it's like sort of negotiating those changes that really have to be made when you're adapting this for television.
I think that's a spoiler that we can get away with at this point.
Yeah, I think so. I hope so.
Isn't enough of the marketing material that, you know, we can confirm that Harvey lives. Sorry, everyone who hasn't
watched it. What a weird show if Harvey had died in the pilot. It would be a completely different show.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Then Sabrina's just like, okay, sure, I'll leave.
Exactly. No problem. Now, I heard... Well, we've actually talked about this. I heard a rumor that Kiernan Shipka is actually allergic to cats, which is why there weren't that many scenes of her actually with the cat version of Salem. Is that true?
It's true that she's allergic. I don't think that that's the reason that she doesn't have as much screen time with Salem as some people may like. I mean, she takes antihistamines whenever she has to do a scene with him. But it's just a different Salem than the old show.
It's because he's hanging out with Ghost and the other direwolves from Game of Thrones.
Exactly. And the truth is that we shifted so much of that character over to Cousin Ambrose. So
yes, that's what I felt.
It would be like a hat on a hat to have him always around.
How do your teams break out? I'm just curious as to the mechanics of a writer's room. Mm-hmm. So how does it break down? Are you working on every episode, or do they break you up into teams, and then who's in charge of continuity?
It's different on every show, but on this show, you know, Roberto's the boss, so he's the head writer, and there are 9 writers that sit at the table with him. We all break the story together, you know, beat by beat, episode by episode, and then you get your assignment, which is an episode. But on this show, we do group writing, so when it's my episode, I assign the beats out to the other writers, and they turn in the scenes to me, and then I sort of Frankenstein all of the scenes together, give it a couple of polishes so it has a unity of voice, and then Roberto does one final polish or two final polishes on my script. So he's the final authority in terms of voice.
So that's almost like a mini executive producer role for you.
Yeah,
for
everybody. Yeah, it is. It's different. Like in A Series of Unfortunate Events, I went away for a month and wrote my two episodes myself. And then, you know, Daniel Handler, the showrunner, got a rewrite on those, but the other writers weren't participating. On this show, it allows us to move really quickly when we write this way. So you can get a first draft in a couple of days rather than a couple of weeks.
Is it because you had to drop everything at once? Well, no, you had to drop everything at once with
Unfortunate Events, too. Yeah,
well, this show, I mean, we operate behind the scenes like a network show because we have to negotiate Roberto's time with Riverdale on CW. So, Series of Unfortunate Events, we wrote all the scripts and then produced them. On this show, we're shooting as we write, like you would on network, just because we have to negotiate with Warner Brothers and the CW for the other show.
How much of a consciousness of Riverdale as a property was there going in? Was there a desire to, obviously that association is going to be made because of Roberto's involvement and just the nature of the comics. Was there a desire to just be like, nope, we have to differentiate ourselves in a certain way or anything like that?
I don't know if anyone really gave it much thought. I'm sure Roberto did behind the scenes, but we didn't talk about it in the room very much. Even though, you know, we share the same offices as the Riverdale writers. They're just down the hall, and Roberto literally splits his day between the two rooms. So, you know, we watch their screenings. We're very aware of the show. We know what's happening on Riverdale, but it feels so different to us that I don't think we think about it very much.
This is just fascinating stuff for those of us who aren't, you know, behind the scenes of this, to see how the sausage actually gets made. But one thing that really struck me about the show, and, you know, I had read going in that it was going to be scary. There was going to be a horror element. But I would say more than your Buffy. I mean, Buffy had its moments, but I was really struck by how into the horror Sabrina leaned. Was that a really big mission statement going in for you guys to really just, we have to make this actually scary for horror fans?
Yeah, that's like Roberto's number one thing. And luckily it's a room full of horror fans. You know, I'm a major horror nerd and have been my whole life. So to be in a room where I can like casually drop a Nightmare on Elm Street 4 reference and people know what I mean, to have that kind of shorthand is really amazing and gratifying. But also I think it's, you know, it is a horror show, but if you compare it to Riverdale, weirdly, I think it's kind of more warm-hearted and innocent than Riverdale is, in a way that surprised me and I think everybody. I mean, there is like a more innocent quality, partially because our kids feel more like real kids than the Riverdale kids do. You know, they're not like blackmailing each other and all that sort of wonderful Riverdale stuff. But because of their protagonists in a horror story, they have to be a little bit innocent because all this terrible stuff is happening to them. So I think it gives the show, even though it's dark and it's horror, it gives it a sort of like innocence and warmth that I found really surprising.
Was there a mandate to kind of weave known horror stuff in there? I mean, the one that struck me the most was when Daniel Webster shows up. I can't remember. I must have read that story in high school, I think, or something like that, The Devil and Daniel Webster. And the fact that, I mean, that's kind of a deep cut. And that it was so integral a part of that episode, I thought was just really, really cool. So was that something you guys, was there like a competition to outdo each other with the best horror Easter eggs?
There's not a competition, but all of us are fans and we delight in sticking in as much stuff as we can. Like my episode is about an exorcism, so obviously there's a lot of stuff from The Exorcist, including direct shots. But there's also a scene where Harvey is in bed and he's wearing the crop top that Johnny Depp wears in A Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yes. Oh my God, somebody else said that. And I was like, are you sure? Oh my God, that you've
when
come,
I was
just
on
lost
set,
a bet. Thank you.
Everyone was like, why is Harvey wearing a crop top? And I was like, first of all, horror fans are going to know and they're going to love it. And second of all, it's for the gays. So back off and make that crop top shorter.
I love how you said it's for the gays.
So there's just like, we all just love sticking in as much stuff like that as we can. And the show is a pastiche, right? So it's the by its very nature, it's just a collage of moments and images from the horror genre kind of pasted together. So it just fits.
What was there one that somebody brought in that I know that you are yourself are kind of a big horror fan. Was there one that somebody brought in that kind of blew your mind, or you were like, wow, that's a name I haven't heard in a long time?
Gosh, now I'm against the wall on this one. I mean, I was really proud of the crop top, but the director.
I love it. That was actually, was that in the script? He is wearing a crop top. Like
yeah.
Johnny Depp in,
yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's amazing.
You were like, there's no one's going to misinterpret this. You will get my meaning.
Yeah. And the directors do a lot of that sort of stuff too on their end. Like Rachel Talalay, who directed the Exorcism episode. This isn't scripted, but she wanted a shot where the three women approach the house and are walking into the lamplight. Like that classic shot of The Exorcist. Mm-hmm. So that's not in the script, but she insisted on that, and it's beautiful. It's like the most beautiful shot in the episode.
Yeah. I was listening to another podcast you did where you mentioned, talked about how you had to be on set for your episode. Do you want to speak a little bit about that, what that process was like for you?
Yeah. Typically on our show, every writer goes to set to quote unquote produce their episode. You know, you always want a writer there so they can keep an eye on story and make sure that, you know, you just know more things as the writer who's from the room than anyone on set might know, because you know what's going to happen. You have a close eye for detail about what's already happened. So it's good to have a writer there. And so when you go to cover your episode, you're in Vancouver. Our show shoots 6 days a week, 14 hours a day. So it's very exhausting. Often you're in the woods at night and it's raining and you're eating like a weird shepherd's pie at 2 a.m. in a tent. But
it's Hollywood magic, baby.
It's really a lot. It's amazing that our crew does that as like their full-time job, because 2 weeks is quite enough for me. But everyone's really lovely. The actors are really sweet on our show. The kids are just having the best time of their life. I say kids, they're all 18 and 22 or whatever, but to
they're
me
kids.
They're kids.
Yeah.
They're kids. They're babies.
They're just having the time of their life up there, so it's pretty fun too.
So were you live tweeting? Like, I know there's a Sabrina's Writers like Twitter account. Like, were you yourself like kind of live tweeting the first, you know, when it dropped and trying to see yourself, people's reactions to the show?
I didn't. I mean, I tweeted about it some, but I mostly just looked. I mean, Riverdale has an easier time with that sort of stuff because they're on network. So yeah. Every week the writers do like an official live tweet. It's really hard to do that when you're on Netflix and everything drops at once. But I mean, a lot of the reactions I predicted, I knew that people would love Miss Wardwell and how devious she is. And I knew that there would be memes about how she was always like poking out from behind a bookshelf or whatever. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, it was really gratifying to see all of the suspicions come true.
Well, Michelle Gomez is amazing. I mean, I'm a Doctor Who fan, so.
And I love that became actually a transition thing from mm-hmm. shot to shot, where she would go behind the bookshelf and suddenly you're in another shot. I was like, that's a very clever use of that trope.
We would laugh about it in the room because we knew. Like, I just can't wait to see someone cut together a super cut of just shots of Michelle peeking out from around a shelf.
Behind a bookshelf.
Or, you know, like,
or the cosplay. So someone needs to do a cosplay as her where they have a bookshelf in front of them the whole time.
Yeah.
That would be amazing. Go ahead, Carol.
No, the other question I had was, this show was beautifully shot, beautifully executed. I liked the, and it's very diverse. I was curious about whether or not, like, not just LGBTQ, but also like ethnicity, race, you know, gender, everything. I was curious as to whether or not the writer's room matched that.
It does, yeah. We actually have no cis, white, heterosexual men in our room. The room is all women and gay
actually
men.
That's Adam clapping.
That is me clapping.
Yeah. We have, it's ethnically diverse. We have trans writer. It's a very, very diverse room, and obviously the cast is as well. And our showrunner is a queer Latinx man, so we've got that too.
And he's done some amazing stuff too. So one of the things that had come out was, I think, I don't know if you heard about this, but some people, actually I shouldn't say some people, a lot of African Americans, like myself, were curious about the choice for the hanging scene. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of people visually, and this always happens in shows where that come out on Netflix where not everybody reads the comic book. Although I don't think the hanging scene is in the comic book, but there was a lot of issues around hanging the witches as well as hanging like a woman of color. Did any of, I'm curious as to how, going into season two, how are some of those discussions handled in the writer's room? Like when you get feedback like that from fans that might be pretty strong, how do you address it?
Well, we've had to talk about it. I mean, we had a really long conversation about it. And that's something that happens when you do colorblind casting and you aren't thoughtful enough. Some things like that can happen. The truth is we have African-American writers. The actress is African-American. People on set were African-American. To be honest, nobody clocked it just because we just didn't clock it. It was an oversight. And so the actress was pretty rattled just because she loves the show and she's really proud of her part in it. And Roberto was really rattled. And so he came into the room after, I think it was a Teen Vogue piece came out, and we had like a 2-hour conversation about it. And, you know, the truth is that when something like that happens, you just have to be more thoughtful and think about things more clearly. You know, I think at the time, I actually wasn't on the show yet when they did that episode, but I think they just thought the witches were hanged in Salem. And the episode was written before it was cast, so no one knew that that was going to be a woman of color. And it just was like a bonehead oversight, I think. And so, you know, the mandate is to be more thoughtful, to have more scrutiny about everything that we do and more thoughtfulness. And, you know, we have one of the most diverse rooms and casts out there, and it still happened. So I don't know what else to say about it besides
that.
No.
I think that's a great response, because I think the problem is, like I said, we were talking about this a few weeks ago about like things on social media, like somebody does something somebody doesn't like in a show and it's like canceled. And I think it's not giving people enough chance or time to course correct or make a change or, you know, look and see and make changes for the next season. So I'm, for one, I love the show. I did think that was a misstep, but I think it's fabulous that there was actually a meeting and people talked about it.
Yeah. I mean, Tati, the actress, I guess, called Roberto when those pieces started to come out, and they had a really long heart to heart about it. So Roberto came to us, and, you know, I don't want to take any agency from Tati, who's like so talented and brilliant.
She's amazing.
And, you know, it's on hers just as much as everyone else. No one clocked it. That's the truth. And so we just all have to be more thoughtful. That's the net, I guess.
And I think that's the interesting thing, again, for those of us who aren't in these writers' rooms to see and hear, because that line between you guys and the people who are consuming this thing that you put out has been so blurred these days, and these takes fly constantly. And just, you know, I know you can't take every piece of criticism to heart or you'll go insane. Yeah. So it's like, what are the ones that kind of resonate and make you consider how you're moving forward? So that's really interesting to hear that.
Yeah. That's one of the biggies. Yeah. That's kind of the only biggie, to be honest. nothing else really seems to penetrate Roberto. He's very confident in his vision. And so it was interesting to see that one penetrate the room.
Have you had any interactions with fans of the show online or out in the real world that who might have known that you were involved that kind of struck you based on how they're receiving what you're putting out there?
Well, I mean, this is the only one. There's a lot of criticisms that I think are dumb. Like the people that want Salem to talk, that's dumb. The complaints about the blurred lenses, that's dumb, as far as I'm concerned. So the conversations around race are the only ones that have really given me a lot of pause. And I don't know. My instinct, if I'm being honest, my initial instinct was anger and frustration, because I thought, oh, well, they're just taking it out of context and blah, blah, blah. But as I sort of checked myself and sat with it, I understood.
Boy, could we all learn from that.
Yeah.
That's a really great way to approach things. But I mean, I meant it too on the positive side. I was wondering if there was anything that, you know, did someone catch a reference that you threw in there that you didn't think anyone would catch or anything like that as well?
Yeah, are there more crop tops coming? Like, yeah. What's happening?
I think maybe crop tops are played out, but like every single thing that people catch is so fun, because some of these are really deep cuts, as you said. There's like My Bloody Valentine in there and Let's Scare Jessica to Death and like all these really obscure horror movies, and people catch them for sure. It's also really fun to see the fan theories because some of them are right. A lot of them are not at all, but it's still pretty gratifying.
Do you choose to be out there in the public space interacting with fans? I mean, mostly through social media. Do you interact with fans, or are you kind of like a, I'm just going to do my thing and filter that as best I can?
Well, he was before this podcast. I'm telling exactly. Everybody. Can't hide anymore. Sorry, Josh.
I like interacting with things. I mean, look, I'm in this business. I have to some extent, I have to use this show to raise my own profile if I want to keep doing this for a living. So it's just part of the deal as far as I'm concerned. I have had to like block people on Instagram or Twitter who kind of cross boundaries, but that's few and far between. Mostly people are really lovely and easy to engage with.
That's how you know you've made it.
Yeah.
You have to start blocking people for harassment. That's right. Congratulations.
Oh, yeah. You're not famous until somebody spells your name wrong and drags you across social media.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Or is that just me?
Yeah.
So you guys are already started on season two.
Yeah, we got a 2-season order, or a 20-episode rather, order from Netflix when we started. So we're always going to do the 20 episodes back to back.
Obviously, you can't get into any details, but thematically, is there any focus this season that's going to shift from the first? Anything we can know about at this point?
I think that what I would say is if season one is Sabrina fully entrenched in her mortal world and dipping her toes into the witch world, season two is kind of the opposite. She's fully entrenched in the witch world and struggling to hold on to the mortal world a little bit. So that's kind of the overarching story.
Will we get more of Ambrose's backstory? Because I like need to know why he tried to blow up the Vatican. I need this.
Yeah, he has a major storyline in season two.
Okay.
He's such a great character.
His boyfriend lives, right?
That I can't tell you.
Oh, man.
But no one is ever safe on Sabrina, so.
That's true. The actors ever kind of wig out? Like, I think of like shows like Lost and Oz and stuff where people could show up and just not know the day that they're going to get killed.
Yeah, I mean, everyone has really crazy stuff to do, and we tried to give a lot more depth to the central characters in season two. So I hope that people like it.
And even if they're killed, you know, they might just come out of the grave.
Anyone can come back.
If they are buried in the proper plot, they could come back.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I don't know. Do you have any more questions, Karen?
That's it for me. I think we're good.
Yeah, Josh, thank you so much for joining us. Congratulations on the show.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. And Sabrina season two is coming in. There's no date, right? Yet.
Early enough. Sometime. Yeah.
But it's coming.
It's coming.
So beware.
Yeah.
Everybody.
But I can't wait. And hopefully, you know, we'd love to talk to you again when season two drops and talk about some more of those little Easter eggs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
So that was our interview with Josh Conkle.
I was really excited about talking to him actually cleared up so many things. I really hope a lot of people listen, because one of the things that we've talked about this before is sort of like this court of public opinion that happens on social media.
Yeah.
And he cleared up a lot of things that people have been like basically kind of just musing about, not with any factual, you know, information. And I think one of the biggest takeaways is that the writer's room actually is very diverse. He actually said, you know, the whole part about there not being any like white male straight men in the writer's room or on the set. Like I'm fascinated by that. And I also think it proves that no matter how much, even though the show is very, very diverse, and I'm really excited about that, missteps can be made, especially if a script is written before it's cast. So, but I'm really looking forward to season two.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed that first season back when I thought I would be a part of this interview, you see. I watched the whole thing. And
but I'm glad you got to the end.
Yeah, it's great. I will say my only criticism of Sabrina, actually, my only narrative complaint is that it took the whole season to get where we were going from the beginning.
Yeah.
They spend a really long time to get to what felt... as though is square one for me. It's a lot of episodes.
But I think that's team dramas. Like,
well, and that, I was okay with that. I kind of, because I didn't feel bored by the stuff that they spent time covering in between.
I felt 10 episodes was a lot for that particular story arc for me.
But it didn't make me want to pull my hair out like 13 Reasons.
Oh, okay.
Like, I know she, like, from the beginning, you know the girl is dead. That's not a spoiler. And yeah. It's like,
what?
It's not. Everybody knows. It's even in the trailer. So it's sort of like, and it took so long for everybody to just come out of their angst, and basically it's told from all these different people's perspectives. And it was like, but that didn't, I didn't get that from this. I felt like it did move along. I wanted Ambrose to get out of that house sooner, though.
Yeah.
But he's adorable.
Ugh, anyway, I think where it ends in season one is great. Mm-hmm. And I look forward to season two, where they finally got to.
Yeah.
I mean, when I say I wish that they had sort of got where they were going a little bit quicker, is the equivalent of saying every show I watch, pretty much, I think. That first season's a little uneven, or I wish they had done things a little bit quicker. Or I wish they hadn't. That's every first season of every show. I think that by the end of season one, I felt very confident that they had a clear identity.
Right.
And not just a visual identity, but also an identity for the characters and the kind of story that they want to tell.
I mean, look at Legends, right? It's the same thing.
Yeah, Legends.
Completely different show now.
Legends was nobody. Absolutely. Nobody who loves Legends says, man, watch that first season. Everybody says the same thing. Skip it. And I don't even feel that you should
same
skip the first Sabrina.
Same thing with S.H.I.E.L.D.
You can still watch the first season of Sabrina. There's still a lot of exciting stuff in there and a lot of great character work in there. And the actors really, I think, make the most of some places that I think drag a little bit. But yeah, I mean, everybody's good and Michelle Gomez is the bomb.
Yes.
I am in love with her. I interviewed her once and it was intense. And that was very early in my interviewing days. Yeah. I was not ready for that. She was amazing though. And she's very good in the show. Anyway, hey, less amazing. It's the World of Games this week.
Sure is.
Yeah, like
I mean, not that this is news, but gaming. It always seems like something's up.
It's true.
Yeah, unfortunately, like this week in stupid. It's like
well, it's just it is a community and an industry that I think has been going through a lot of growing pains over a lot of years.
And I mean, like, it's a very young industry.
In various phases, right? There have been phases of growing pains that have happened, and then things settle for a while, and it's just, I mean, it's so huge now. I mean, just the amount of money involved is insane.
Yeah, and I mean, when I was a kid, just the concept of being able to make $1 million gaming.
Well, you know what I was going to say, like, I mean, like, one of the biggest pieces of news that came out was Red Dead Redemption, which had all of this back frontlash, I guess we could say, over the amount of work that was done on it. But all of those complaints, boy, it made more money than I forget how many different films in their first week.
Yeah,
it made so much.
It's the number one game right now. Like,
but not only is it the number one game, but it is out maneuvering money making most films.
I mean, it's $60 a copy, so it's not really. I mean, that's a little.
But the thing is that
$60.
There is this sort of notion that people don't buy games as much, or when they do buy games, that people are mostly mobile gamers, which is something we'll get to. But that was a game that whether you were casual or hardcore alike, it seems as though everybody picked it up. Otherwise, $60 seems like a lot of money, but
I have not yet picked it up.
I haven't either, but most people I know are playing it.
Right.
So,
and a lot of people I know that, like you said, aren't putting a lot of money into games, saved, and they were like, I'm buying two games this year, Spider-Man
and Red Dead.
And Red Dead Redemption. Yeah. Like, they were, these are the two that they were buying.
Yeah.
Yeah. Meanwhile, which to begin with?
Let's start with Blizzard.
Sure. Okay. So, Adam, take it away.
I'm going to take it away. So, because Blizzard is a company that has been near and dear to my heart for a long time. Basically, what happened is that BlizzCon was this past weekend. And leading into BlizzCon, Blizzard put out an announcement that was like, hey, there's going to be a Diablo announcement. And all the fans were like, oh my God, Diablo 4 is coming. And then Blizzard said, or it's not Diablo 4, you guys. And then everybody kind of went off in various different theories. And I think the one that most people settled on was that we were going to get some kind of remaster of one of the older versions of the game. cut to BlizzCon, and Blizzard announces that what it actually is a game called Diablo Infinite that is on for mobile platforms, for phones.
Basically. It's Diablo Immortal.
Immortal. I keep saying Infinite. I'm sorry. Diablo Immortal. It's going to be on mobile platforms, and the reaction was not what they were hoping for, which is to say that someone got up at the con and asked them if it was an early April Fool's joke in front of God and everyone, which and it only snowballed from there. It was just a really bad PR moment for the company, a company that to date has not had to face that kind of fan backlash. They have a very passionate, very dedicated fan community. There's certainly been some issues here and there with World of Warcraft and people getting upset about certain things, but on the whole, they've never faced this kind of thing.
Public scrutiny.
Yeah, scrutiny. And they didn't react well. Like, the you know, Blizzard's reaction was a little defensive, but, you know. So anyway, it unpacks a lot of things about, you know, gamer entitlement, what we can expect from these companies, but also hype and how these companies kind of build this hype and then don't have to face the fact that if they don't deliver on it, people are going to be upset. And I think the vast majority of gamers that I saw commenting on this probably fell somewhere. They weren't on the extreme end of like, Blizzard is horrible and blah. It was more just like, they said they were going to deliver something really cool. And what we got was, and this is on top of the fact that Immortal, by all accounts, is a reskin of a previously existing game.
And the other thing about this is that, mobile games that are of a Diablo type exist.
Yes.
There are lots of them. They're mostly mediocre. And also, Blizzard isn't making this.
Right.
Somebody else is.
Right.
So it feels...
They just slapped their name on
it. So the thing is, it's kind of coming into a glut. Now, if it was them making it,
right,
I do think that there is a way that people would have been less angry. I mean, I acknowledge absolutely this is an issue of... PC gamers have a very, they get very possessive about certain things. And I think that Diablo is certainly one of those franchises that they feel a real ownership for. And there is a real kind of concept that, cell phone, mobile games have a casual quality to them. And in addition, there is always that concern that a mobile game inherently is going to be something that is designed not for play, but for you to have to pay more and more money. It's just sort of, it's free, quotes, but then it's just pay to play, which is not really fun. So I think while I understand that gamers have a tendency to have a certain type of entitlement, I think that because there's already a glut of these games, because it's not specifically made by Blizzard, because the trailer that people saw did not look like something that was really going to put a stamp or bring something core from Diablo into the mobile world, plus the fear of mobile games in these regards. I think I understand. I understand the frustration.
I understand the frustration on some level, but on the other hand, first of all, this is games. We're talking about games.
Sure.
Like, by definition, they are a indulgence, something you do for fun. And it's just, I don't ever understand the severity of the backlash, because Diablo 3 is still out there. All these games are still out there. There's a million games to play right now that are good for hardcore PC gamers. You can go on Steam and download 15 different games that are super grognardy and really good. And so, yeah, be disappointed, you know, like be underwhelmed by this announcement. I'm not going to get into it, but the amount of rage that was unleashed by this, it's just out of proportion, I guess, to me, with the degree of underwhelmingness of the announcement. You know what I mean? I just don't think it's worth getting that worked up over. There's so many things going on in the world that are worth getting worked up over, so much more worked up over than this. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm not going to play Diablo Immortal. I have no desire to play that game. But that's okay. And I'll move on, and I'll wait until Blizzard comes out with something cool, and then I'll play that.
Yeah.
And there you go.
All right. That's fair. I mean, what I would say is this. I think there's a Polygon article called Diablo Immortal Broke the Unspoken Rules of Blizzard and BlizzCon by Ben Kuchera that sort of talks about the way that they've done announcements in the past, the way that they've done games in general, and sort of why this breaks with a kind of tradition. And so whether gamers knew this or not, there, I think what was set up is that there's been a sort of expectation and payoff that is happening in a somewhat formulaic way with Blizzard and with BlizzCon announcements specifically, that this doesn't fit. And so whether or not that makes the aggressiveness of the response right or fair, I think it contributes to the fact that it was as extreme because sure. there was sort of a subversion in a way that people were going to, almost based on a formula, be extremely dissatisfied by. And I think that's a really interesting point. I think it's sort of one of those things that's marketing and synergy where you have to think about that kind of stuff. And so in the end, I look at it and think there's just some lessons that I think that Blizzard could probably learn about.
Oh, yeah,
the way they presented this idea is all. By acknowledging that people are extreme about stuff aside, I don't think it was the best marketing move.
No, definitely not. And their reaction to the backlash, I think, was a little bit, you know, defensive and not necessarily.
Never. That never works. It just turns
yeah,
out.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just don't people are never like, wow, you're right. I was wrong.
Corporate posturing is yeah. not a good look.
So, yeah, I mean, listen, Blizzard has all the money, so I don't think they're going to suffer for this. And
yeah,
the next,
they'll be fine.
When they announce the next Diablo or whatever, people are going to eat it with a spoon. Yeah. So,
and I mean, that is the other yeah. thing. I looked it up and I had not realized, but Diablo 3, the last full new Diablo game, was announced a decade ago.
Yeah.
2008 was the last time they announced a full Diablo. So while it was a number of years before that game actually came out, and I think to that point, that's why people are really frothing for more, because even to start seeing stuff a bit about Diablo 4 suggests that it's still probably going to be a little while before that game comes out, because that's how PC games work.
Right.
And that market has not changed in that regard. So, yeah, I mean, I think people are really – that's one way. They could have announced that game and then still also – they were supposed to have a tease. They were supposed to have a Diablo 4 tease, and then they didn't show it. And so, yeah, yikes. Had that been there, I think that would have also mitigated a lot of circumstance.
I agree.
Anyway, so that is the Blizzard's end of things. Karima, what about Riot Games?
Well, I'm in the interest of time, I'll just keep it short and sweet. Basically, Riot Games this week is being sued. It's about 3 months after an investigative report by Kotaku. They are being sued by two very, very particular employees. Melanie McCracken and Jessica Negron. Negron was a former employee, and they are citing multiple harassment and things like that. They're also pushing it for it to be a class action lawsuit. The investigation and a lot of the claims of basically violating the California Equal Pay Act and sexual discrimination, basically. They've come out in the record to talk about it, and it's last week there was a League of Legends tournament, so it was a big gaming weekend, and so a lot of people were praising the company for another great year at the tournament, but then also saying again, why are there not only no female developers, but why are there never any female gamers in the tournament? So, and it's they tried a preemptive strike back in August that failed miserably. They at PAX West had a panel that was basically for women and non-binary people only, and they excluded all men so that they could take a look at just potential candidates' art and work. But that actually doesn't solve the problem either. Like, shutting all the men out doesn't
it creates a kind of ghetto. Also,
right, and
which
also
is not ideal.
No, and of course, people like men and women were upset about this, because that's basically not how you solve the problem. Solving the problem is like, let's figure out how we can all make this work together. Not no men, all the women over here, all the men over there. That's in this
yeah,
case.
That's a junior high school dance.
Yeah, it's not going to work. So, and it failed miserably. They got dragged all up and down social media. So, and unfortunately, a lot of horrible things have been coming out in terms of things that were happening in workplaces. Women making presentations and being told that they're not, or not even just being ignored. And also just people who work for the company being quoted as saying some pretty toxic things. Like, getting my groups mixed up. We make our games for straight white teenage boys. We don't make them for girls, sort of like. And that's the other controversy that's come out of it. And it's unfortunately another, I would love to say this is the last time we're ever going to hear about something like this, but of course in this climate we're not. But yeah, they started the week they tried to start the week on a high note, but it didn't end very well for them. So yeah, Riot Games, which is based is actually in South Korea, is getting sued.
Yeah, I would say this. This is, you talked about this time, and we talked about it a little beforehand, wherein we acknowledge the possibility, and I would say even outright likelihood, that companies will say, what can we market towards? And that there are genuinely companies that will say, let's market towards these extremely angry, disenfranchised white folks. And the thing is, in a way, it kind of feels like they are trying to directly market to them. If they're saying, I'm saying,
are they disenfranchised?
They certainly feel that they are. And the problem is I find it to be unethical to market towards that, towards essentially what is a false narrative, and one that is not just a false narrative, but one that is creating anger. These are people who do, I mean, however you feel about it, these are people that do feel disenfranchised, and there is already a political movement. I say we won't talk about politics, and this is the only thing I'll say, but there is a political movement that is trying to engage these folks in a way that is designed to scare them to violence, and to market towards that is to contribute to that.
I mean, this actually ties in, I think, if we said we weren't going to get into politics, but NPR just published an article this week about alt-right recruitment in the gamer community.
Yes.
And it was pretty scary. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely something there to what you're talking about.
Before we get completely off topic, I do want to say that Riot did, at the end of the week, to Sci-Fi actually send a comment. And I just want to read it real quick. While we do not discuss the details of ongoing litigation, we can say that we take every allegation of this nature seriously and investigate them thoroughly. We remain committed to a deep and comprehensive evolution of our culture to ensure Riot is a place where all writers thrive. It sounds a little legalese and boilerplate, but let's hope that they're going to
do
something.
Well, and maybe they mean it. And the hard part is just I feel like this is a culture that is evolving and it's happening in fits and starts.
Well, sure.
And I think that a company can say whatever it wants and make its corporate policy whatever it wants, but it's hard to dictate people's behavior in the day to day that way. You know what I mean?
Sure. Like, but look,
their attitudes in that way. And so I'm not saying that I'm saying for better or worse. Like, this is just the way it is. Gaming for a long time was male dominated. I mean, it just really was. And it's, you know, if you were a gamer girl, you were definitely in the minority she's a gamer girl. It's such a weird, crazy thing, you know? And now that is changing and has been changing, and it's getting to a point of it being, you know, more equal. And I think that it's just going to, there's a lag. There's a lag of attitude among the people who've been involved in it for a while who think of it as this certain, in a certain way. I don't have to, you know, think about how I speak around gamers, because this gamer, you know, no one's going to be offended if I make some, you know, sexist joke or whatever. But now you do.
Right. And I mean, what has happened is there has been enough empowerment. I've made off-color jokes. And what I think that I have learned over my lifetime is that as people have started to come to me and say, you made this joke and I didn't like it, I realized that for every one person that said it, there were a much larger number that I can't calculate of people who didn't say it but felt it. And so that has dictated my thought process. And I think that that is something that is going to have to happen across industry. Just, you know, as you said, people have this concept or had a concept of the gamer girl as though women didn't play games. But that wasn't really reality.
Right.
Yeah. You know, I think the thing for me, and this is just because I feel like we have these conversations, not just us, but we, like, collectively, we have these conversations ad nauseum, and you hear and see all these things like, well, I don't know what I'm supposed to say anymore. I don't know what I'm supposed to do anymore. Like that gamer that won't play with women anymore on Twitch because he's afraid that something he'll do or say something stupid. Yeah. And it's like, I don't understand how difficult it is to just not be an ass. Like, why is it, like, why do we have to have corporate mandates?
Because we've spent a really long time, but as I said, a really long time having no, where you just live in a culture where nobody says anything.
Right.
Because you're in the position of power, you don't realize that you have this is the privilege conversation, wherein you have no idea that you've got it because nobody said anything, and now all of a sudden everyone's saying it to you all the time, and you feel very overwhelmed
by that. And not only were you not, a lot of these people not restricted from saying those things, you also were often rewarded
right.
for behaving okay. and acting that way. So it's you go from a world, and I'm not trying to have full sympathy for people because I think people need to be empathetic and really think about these things. But like you go from a world where there were no rules to and you've been rewarded for you've had certain rewards, you know, indoctrinated into your head and certain behaviors that become habits. And now you're told you can't do it anymore. And that's good. I mean, hopefully we can all take a step back and say, well, let me look at the bigger picture and understand that my personal, you know, reward structure in my brain isn't worth hurting other people. But I think that that's for some people, and that's a really hard adjustment. And it's because it's obvious because it's still, we're having these conversations, you know, now. So I don't know. I mean, I think it's going to change. It'll take time. The pendulum will swing eventually, and people, especially as these conversations happen more and more.
As always, I just the same thing happens to me over and over again, which is I mean there are moments. You know, it was so on the one hand, I did this podcast Everyday Horror, right? I did every single day. I put stuff out, and I'll call it out. Here's a thing that happened. I put an article out for an episode called Drag Me to Hell. There's a movie called Drag Me to Hell. We did an episode on it. And I made a joke in the Shell article about eating disorders because there was a whole thing about, is this movie actually an analog for eating disorders? And I said, there's only one way to find out. Get an eating disorder. JK, just read the podcast. And I put that out in the world. And my co-host on that episode was Courtney Enlow. And she was like, hey, delete that shit. That's messed up. Especially knowing my personal background, articles that I've written about on this very topic, this joke is not funny.
Right.
And yet I was the same person who, when I said, we're going to do Everyday Horror, I said, we got to make sure we represent as many people as we can in those 31 days. That's an important goal. So I'm a person that's thinking about those things and I still messed up.
Yeah.
And that's reality, but that happens and no one's going to get it right all the time. Right.
No, exactly. And that's what we were just saying when Josh was, you know, when we were talking to him about mistakes made on Sabrina. I think the other take is that, okay, if somebody gets called out on something, give them a chance to fix it. If they don't fix it,
right,
then drag them to hell.
Well, and I will say, I think on the gaming side,
get that, get it.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I was with you.
It's gonna go away over time because so many. I think among young people now, and I say that as an old man, but among you know teens, there isn't that
Father
idea. Father
Time joined us today.
I don't think as a male thing. There are so many female gamers now, and it's not as much a thing as it used to be.
Yeah, like, I mean,
as the generations age out and gaming is just more universal, these conversations won't happen as much anymore because people will be learning how they have to interact with other gamers from the start, from the jump, that they can't, you know, they have to have certain considerations for gender and sexuality and
not just that, stopping,
all kinds of stuff. So,
and stop being such a sore loser because none of these guys have a problem if they beat a girl or a woman of color. They get mad when one of them beats them.
Oh, yeah.
Stop being a sort. Just stop being a sort.
But again, I think that'll change. I think that'll change over time. Yeah, I really do.
To me, it's just a growing pain.
Right.
I mean, fundamentally, like with all things, you just.
It's
adapting. It's like anything. It's like, do you remember? Do you ever encounter new writers where they say, "I want to do this thing," where they want to write as we do, but then they say, "But I'm so precious about the things that I write." And you're talking about churning out all this content. You just say, "Listen, the reality is, when I started writing, I was precious too." You adapt.
Right.
You have to. That's it. And in life, that's what we do. We adapt to new circumstances. This is not a negative circumstance. This is just us catching up to what was already a reality. In this case, we're talking about women gamers. Yes,
right.
Women already playing games. Just as, you know, this weird outside source of the people perceiving horror as a misogynist male culture, when in fact more women watch horror movies than men do. Again, it's this weird thing where everybody's got to get caught up. And it's not just from within the gaming community. It's also from without. It's also the outside world of sort of acknowledging things. So, I mean, it's not a painful process, I don't honestly think. I think that people, by being so rigid, because they think something's going to be bad, make it a painful process. But it's not really – I mean, wow, women are here in the space, or a lot more games feature women characters or people of color or queer – I mean, I don't – once it's happened, once it's there in the world, it's fine.
And again, and I just keep harping on this, the generational thing will happen because – there will be people who grew up with games with more female characters and all that stuff. And they won't be weird. It won't be like, oh, this is a change.
Yeah.
That'd just be the way it is. I mean, that's it. Like, you look at acceptance of sexuality. I mean, our society as a whole is so much more accepting than it was a long time ago. But for kids, who've grown up in a world where, I mean, there are kids growing up now in a world where, you know, men can marry men, women can marry women, and it's great. And nobody says anything about, I mean, people say things about it, but well, no, but I'm saying, like, it's more, you know, it's on TV. There, people are on TV. It's just there. It's part of the
fabric.
It's
more normalized.
It's part of the fabric, right? And I think that for younger people, they would, a lot of younger people wouldn't bat an eye over, you know,
I mean,
same-sex marriage or something. So I think
people are saying that what this is politics and games. But the reality is that it's just life and games.
Yeah,
and as time sort of wears on, I do think that there will be just a reality of that stuff, and it won't feel as innately quote politicized.
Right.
You know, I mean, the ultimate goal is to sort of make it so that people's very identities are not innately politicized to such a degree that games, as you said with Blizzard, a place where we're supposed to go to just have a certain degree of fun, that innate politicization of a person's identity will sort of be reduced at the very least.
I mean, the one thing I will say, and I've noticed this, I noticed this in the reaction to the NPR article that came out, I've noticed it in the reaction to certain other things over the years, is that the gaming community really needs to, I think that it bred in the 90s and around that time when people were really attacking violence in games.
And blaming violence in music and games and pop culture.
Right, right. But I'm saying, specifically with the gaming community, there was this turtle mentality. Or not turtle, like a puffer fish. Mm-hmm. You know, someone attacks gaming. No! And everybody gets super defensive and super angry as if they're being personally attacked. And it's you know, I got into discussion online about this with the NPR article where it says, like, if you are a gamer and someone says, hey, gaming has this problem, or the gaming community has this issue, that does not mean that you are bad or that you have a problem or that you know, it just means that this thing that you enjoy has things that needs to be worked out. And guess what? That's true of everything. And so the gaming community, I think, needs to get less defensive about a lot of this stuff and a little more self-reflective and just acknowledge that there can be issues, but it doesn't mean everything is awful. You know, yes, gaming has a sexism problem for sure. And it has for pretty much its entire existence, but that does not mean that it's evil. That does not mean
video games bad.
Right, exactly. And I think a lot of people's reactions when they hear stuff like this is to adopt that fists up mindset of like, oh yeah, no, it's not, and games are perfect. And it's like, no, you know, it's okay. They're a problem. Like, I mean, God, this is the whole origin of Gamergate, and I hate to get into that aspect.
Yeah,
but,
you know.
It's like, you know, Sarkeesian came out and said there is an issue. She didn't say we should abolish gaming. She didn't say gaming is horrible and going to turn everyone into a horrible person. She said there is an issue in gaming that we need to look at. And the immediate reaction is to get defensive rather than, even if you disagree about the issue, to just have the discussion. You know what I mean? And I think that defensiveness, again, comes from partially because, I think a lot of gamers growing up, you know, at least when I was growing up, honestly, the hardcore gamers were a little more like the socially isolated people, you know, so we were already kind of under attack in a certain sense when I was a kid. And then also just from that idea of the attempt to vilify games in a certain way that happened in the late 90s and early 2000s. So people, just, you know, it's okay. It's okay to discuss these issues. It's okay to look at it and examine the hobby and examine the community and examine the companies that are making it and have these discussions. And it doesn't mean gaming is bad. It doesn't mean gaming is going to go away. That's my speech. The end.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, and also, I mean, gosh, the flip side of it. And I saw a great tweet thread about how a lot of news outlets are spending so much time on the politics end that they've allowed their culture departments to all kind of either go away completely or be greatly reduced. And there's no other sites that are sort of picking up. There are a lot of places, a lot of sort of general news websites have destroyed their cultural mandate and have focused purely on what Donald Trump said today, because that's where the clicks are coming from. But the reality is that it's okay to just say, this game came out and it was fun. Let's talk about this fun game.
Right.
Or this movie came out and it was fun. Let's talk about this fun movie. Or I didn't like this movie. Let's make some jokes about it. You know, let's dunk on it in a non-political. That's okay. You know, this is the one thing I think that everybody kind of has in common When you say keep your politics out of my games, out of my comics, or whatever it is, I mean, innately, there's no way to do that completely. But
no, because
there,
a lot of the narratives
also,
are reflections of the larger society. And that's why I get confused when people say that. I'm like...
Right. But on the flip side, there is also just straight entertainment.
Although nobody can explain Death Stranding to me yet. So.
Okay. We'll get there. We're going to get there. But yeah, I mean, you know, but we can also talk about... Oh, Spider-Man came out. That was great.
Yeah. I'm still playing Spider-Man. It's
there
great.
You go. You know,
love
yeah.
it.
Tomb Raider, fun. But yeah, I mean, that's I think that's also on our end too. Because if we do nothing but report or convince ourselves that all the best clicks are going to come from our political hot takes, and that's all we focus on all the time, we're also breeding this kind of mentality where that's what people will focus on.
Sure.
So, hey, on that note, how about The Walking Dead? That's a show. That is a show that is arguably the thing that is churning out the continued popularity of zombies for the last however many seasons that it's been on.
I think churning is a really good word.
It is.
Because that's
sure
all
is.
It's kind of doing. It's not having good numbers this season.
But what's interesting to me is that they are... So this week, the news was Andrew Lincoln, who has ostensibly been the star of the show.
Rick Grimes.
From the start, has left. He had his last episode. Everybody thought they're going to kill Rick Grimes, and they didn't. Spoiler alert, if you didn't, it's been out for a week, but the people have been talking about it, so I don't know how you would have missed it, but if you did, sorry. Now more spoilers. Not only did he not die, but he also got picked up by a helicopter. He got taken to this sort of mythic place that we've sort of had a sense of on the show, where things are going on. We don't know what they are, but not only is his story going to continue, but it's going to continue with a trilogy of features, and also they time jumped on the show, and now we've got a lot of these kids are older, and it's years. It's not the first time they time jumped, but this is the most they've gone many, many, many years into the future now. And this is, yes, absolutely a bid for them to try and bring back their old audience, to try and find a way to get a new audience. And they're trying to do it in two ways, right? Because one, the show is still going to have, as by its very nature, is going to have characters that people know that satisfy a long form narrative. And I think that the Rick Grimes stuff, because at this point he's such a iconic character that most people, even if they've never seen the show, know who he is. Those movies don't require, I think, a lot of knowledge of Walking Dead. I think that you can watch them almost in a World War Z kind of way, or any kind of zombie movie, where you just will probably get what you need to know within the first 5 minutes. And everything else is going to be pretty fresh, because they're not dealing with that helicopter stuff on the show, really. So it's kind of its own entity. And I think that's interesting. I'm not a huge Walking Dead fan, because I don't personally get into the idea of zombies going on and on and on in one singular story for 8 seasons.
Well, I like my zombies to be more like World War Z. Like those zombies.
I mean,
I don't like those. I don't like fast zombies.
I like fast zombies.
Interesting.
I
like a slow zombie too. Yeah.
But what is interesting with that a lot of people have been focusing on Rick Grimes character leaving, which they should. But some other interesting news that came out this week is that Danai Gurira, who plays Michonne, is basically poised to now be the top billed character on the show, which I might watch more if that happens. But I think that's, you know, fantastic. And also there's like legions of fans to this to this franchise. And I think the thing that is weird is that I think fans, after, because he'd been there so long since the very first episode, I think they wanted his last episode to be more. Fans didn't seem to be pleased. They didn't think it was as epic as it should have been. That's the feeling I got from online.
It's interesting. I mean, I would say the response was pretty divisive, because I saw a number of articles where people said, just by virtue of the fact that it was so bananas, that people really didn't see, because genuinely everyone just assumed he would die, or at least most people did, having not really been a huge part of the ongoing Walking Dead culture. I couldn't speak to what I would have thought, but most people I talked to just assumed that he was going to die. And yeah, it's a huge sort of either backlash or positive response to the idea that he didn't die. Either that's a cop out, or, I'm going to finally get this other completely different story with this character. That sounds cool. And also now a completely separate, maybe deny Michonne sort of focused story is also exciting. And I mean, the name of the game of any show that's been on that long. It's, boy, it's really hard. We talked about Supernatural last week, didn't we? Where I said that's a show that's on, what, season 14 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Insanity it is. It's really hard to
this
keep.
Is that kind of thing, yeah.
Really hard to keep an audience. So yeah. I'm curious as to.
Well, and it's funny because The Walking Dead has been, it's so funny when you read these audience numbers and, you know, The Walking Dead has been hemorrhaging.
Yeah.
All season.
Audience. But it's still a monster hit.
Yeah, and everybody still talks about it.
Sure, they've lost millions of viewers, but they still have millions of viewers. They have numbers that any TV show would kill for. So, I don't know. It's. I mean, again, I'm not a Walking Dead watcher either for a long time, so I'm not particularly invested in this, and I didn't see the episode where Rick left. I think it's good that they didn't kill him, because I think that we've come to accept character death as like shorthand for stakes in TV now. Because I guess for a long, it's this reaction to the circular storytelling we used to have where nobody ever died and nothing changed and everything was the same for all time. And now, again, I think because of shows like The Walking Dead and Game of Thrones and things like that, it's like the only way that you can deal with stakes in a character's life is life or death. And I'm glad that that wasn't the case here. They came up with a different solution. I don't know that I'm on board for a Walking Dead movie of any kind.
I'm actually
Walking Dead features.
I'm like, completely interested in
are
that.
You?
Not, I
don't
know.
2 hours doesn't bother you as much as this.
Well, no, that's the thing. When it comes to zombies, yeah, if it's just an hour and a half to 2 hours of a zombie movie, even if it's plot heavy, even if it's, you know, going to have elements of the show to it, that is okay by me, because I understand that there is a beginning, a middle, and end. Yeah. Here's the first movie is going to have a big beginning, a middle, and end if it's a real movie. And yes, it is going to be part of a larger story, but that's okay. I mean, that still to me is fundamentally different from a no end in sight season after season after season of people being burned out.
But
and
do you think you're
going
to be able to
on.
Approach it without having been? I mean, because it's not entirely a self-contained thing. Rick Grimes is a character who has a long history now, and if you go in not knowing any of that, are you going to be able to?
I think that if they're smart, and I believe that they are, I think that they will give you the information you need. Just, I mean, I recommend to people at any point in time that they can jump into any old comic. Just read the little thing at the beginning, and anything that doesn't make sense, just go back and read things here or there. But any good comic series is the kind of thing that you can pick up and get what you need from the context clues and enjoy that on its own, and then feel excited about the idea of digging back in and finding out other details if you really want that. I am a believer in that. I'm a believer in the movies, and I am a believer in the idea of starting with a different character as your lead. The very first thing I thought of when I heard about what they were doing with Rick and with the potential for Michonne going forward and the time jump, I thought of Blake 7. Blake 7 is a sci-fi show from Britain that I love very much, but Blake was gone starting in season 3. He was gone, and one of the other absolute, like the two characters that people really identify with most, the ones that seem to be the most fundamentally good people who maybe had a will they or won't they thing going on, they were both gone. And starting in season 3, they had the most malicious malcontent as the hero of the show. It was fundamentally so different. And in their 4th season, they had a completely different, I mean, everything changed from year to year after that. And it worked. And I believe that things like that can work, that a time shift is not inherently bad. People automatically get very clenchy about the idea of moving a story forward in that way. But I think done well,
it's worked really well. I mean, Battlestar did a great job with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways it worked, in some ways it didn't. But yeah, Battlestar is a really good example of sort of the hit and miss of it. But the thing is, I think that you're going to hit and miss with anything. Almost nothing's a home run. But yeah,
except for this podcast.
Except for who won the week. Damn right. But yeah, I mean, I actually honestly came out of it being more interested in The Walking Dead than I have been in a long time. I'll go now. If you're telling me that Danai Gurira is going to be the lead, yeah, I'll give that show a shot. I'm interested in that. That we're going to push forward enough that I can jump in and not have to know every single thing about the years with the backstory, that this is a real jumping on point for me. Sounds great. Maybe it'll even make me go back and watch some of the older stuff that I missed. To me, isn't that their goal? I have to tell you, if that was the goal, and I'm pretty confident it is, it worked on me. But at least potentially. At least I'm thinking about it, a thing that I was not thinking about last week.
All right.
So that's our show. Thank you for listening. If you are not subscribed to Who on the Week, please subscribe to it. If you've never given us a review, please do. They really do help. And check out all the other Sci-Fi Wire podcasts, Strong Female Characters, Fandom Files, any of the podcasts related to the shows that we have on the network. Check out our Amazon podcasts on Alexa. And yeah, thanks, my friends, for being on the show with me every week for 3 years or 1 year. 1 year still a long ass time.
Yes.
Where can people find you? Not on your house, because that would be weird, but on the internet.
People can find me on Instagram at RockTheFaces.
And they can also find you in the Jesus play.
That's right.
The Zombie
and
Jesus
at the Brick
play.
Theater in Williamsburg, Brooklyn.
They can find me, Karima, the Blurred Girl, T H E B L E R D G U R L, all over the interwebs, but mostly Twitter and Instagram.
Cool. And my name is Danny Roth, and you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Danny Ordinary. That is Danny with one N, Ordinary, also with one N. This has been Who Won the Week. Thank you for winning our week, and we'll see you again next week.